The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our online daily news site and author of a new book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on preventing the next Godzilla. Not everyone is familiar with the details of Godzilla's origin story. Yes, he is a giant rampaging lizard monster that arose from the depths of the sea. But did you know he was called forth by radiation? Some even say the entire storyline of these many, many, many giant lizard movies came out of this threat of nuclear weapons and radiation. So, Dave, what are some of the dangerous effects that radiation have on the body?
Well, Godzilla aside, radiation can be very deadly. First, it strikes the bone marrow, so it can wipe out a lot of critical blood cells. But with high doses of radiation, something called radiation-induced gastrointestinal syndrome, or RIGS, happens. And that's basically when the intestines essentially get fried. And this can cause fluid loss, diarrhea, vomiting, and a lot of infections, which ultimately can lead to death.
So here we're looking at a study that's trying to prevent that from happening when you're exposed to radiation. How do they actually try to do this?
Well, researchers focused on a couple of proteins known as hypoxia-inducible factor 1 and 2. And what they know is that these proteins play a role in maintaining the integrity of the intestines. So they figured because radiation wreaks such havoc on the intestines, maybe they could boost the level of these proteins and protect the intestines and therefore protect us against radiation.
And so they first took a genetic approach where they actually made more of this protein in mice, and then they moved over to a drug-based approach. How much protection were they able to see with these interventions?
Well, what happened was this drug actually seemed to boost the levels of these two proteins. And what they found is that when they gave it to mice and the irradiated mice, the mice that did not receive the drug died within 10 days of exposure. But those that had been given the drug were still alive after 60 days. And what's more, even if they gave the drug after the mice had been exposed to radiation, they still had a much higher survival rate than the mice that hadn't been given the drug.
But this isn't going to prevent cancer arising later in life for these mice.
Well, it's hard to know whether these drugs are going to protect against the long-term impacts of radiation. But what the scientists think is happening is it's at least protecting the intestines long enough so they have time to repair themselves so you don't have some of these other long-term effects.
Is this being tested in people?
Well, what's really cool is this drug's actually already being tested in a clinical trial for anemia. So it's possible that if it is proven very effective against radiation, it could move to the market a lot quicker. So, for example, if there was another Fukushima, this could be a drug that's dispensed far and wide to protect the general population.
There's also mention of using this drug to decrease the effects of radiation treatment on cancer patients. Is that likely to be effective?
It's unclear. There's a lot of side effects of radiation therapy, and this could theoretically protect against those side effects. The problem is some research suggests that this may actually protect tumors from radiation, which is obviously the last thing that you want. So it's still a little unclear about how this could be applied to humans.
Next up, we have a story on the health of bullies. Bullying no longer belongs to the secretive domain of the playground and after-school hangout spots. Adults are on the lookout, seeking to save kids from punches, pinches, and psychological damage. But now there's another factor to worry about: CRP levels. So Dave, what's this initialism for?
This stands for C-reactive protein, and it's a marker of inflammation and disease. People with higher CRPs tend to have more chronic illness, including cardiovascular disease and diabetes and chronic pain. We already knew that bullying could have some long-term impacts. Kids that are bullied tend to be more suicidal when they're older. They also tend to have poorer health. But it was unclear why exactly this happened, and CRP may be the key to the puzzle.
So the researchers tried to look and see if bullied kids had different levels of this protein than other ones?
They did. They did this long-term study where they took kids that were about 16, surveyed them about whether they were bullied or whether they were bullies, took some blood, and then looked at their CRP levels over several years until they were about 21 years of age. And they found some pretty striking things. They found that the kids that were bullied had much higher CRP levels than the general population. What was really interesting was that bullies actually had lower levels of CRP than average.
And no one's trying to suggest that CRP causes bullying or lack of it.
That's right. This is just sort of a marker for why the people that are bullied may be having some of these chronic problems later in life. Because even years after the bullying incidents, a lot of these people that had elevated CRP levels continued to have elevated CRP levels, which could explain why the negative impacts of bullying last later on into life.
So does this mean that we should encourage kids to be bullies and preserve their health?
Probably not. It does suggest that, you know, we know actually already that people that tend to be well off, that tend to be higher on the social totem pole, also tend to be healthier. This could explain also why bullies are healthier, because they have an advantage or they take advantage of others, but probably not the best take-home point here. It does suggest that we should be much more vigilant about bullying, because now we have even stronger evidence of its long-term impacts on health.
Lastly, we have a story on the genetics of rascally rabbits. There have been many studies on the genetics of animal domestication. How did dogs go from slavering wolves to friendly companions? Is there a gene that's been switched off? But it turns out that this has been difficult to study. Dave, can you outline some of the reasons that this has been such a problematic area to research?
One of the biggest problems is that the ancestors of a lot of these domestic animals, whether it be dogs or horses or sheep, these animals were domesticated so long ago, you know, up to 10,000 or more years ago. So much time has passed that we have a really hard time comparing the modern animal to its ancestor.
What the researchers decided to do in this case is turn to rabbits. Why did they pick those animals?
Because rabbits are actually a fairly recently domesticated species. Scientists think they were domesticated around 1,400 years ago, and the event that may have led to their domestication was a pope declaring that rabbits technically qualified as fish and could be eaten during Lent, and that caused a lot of the priesthood to bring wild rabbits into the fold and start essentially domesticating them.
So where do the rabbits originate, and what do they look at in the wild and domesticated ones now?
Well, the rabbits actually have a pretty limited range. They're from Spain, Portugal, and southern France, so it's really easy to go back to those places and find the wild ancestors of today's rabbits. When the researchers compared the DNA, though, of these wild rabbits to their domestic cousins, instead of finding this one gene for domestication, which is what a lot of researchers had suspected, they found thousands of very small nuanced changes within the genome that seem to have led to domestication.
Do these results stand alone? Are there other animals that have been shown to have a similar domestication history written into their genes?
Well, it may be possible that something similar happened with rats. We don't think of rats as being domesticated, but actually the rats that live around us and the rats that we have as pets are actually far more domestic than their wild relatives. So something similar has been seen with rats, which suggests that whether we're talking about dogs, cats, or other animals, that this may hold true across most, if not all, domesticated species.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about creating the most magnetic thing in the universe. Also a story about how octopuses don't tie themselves in knots. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about why lectures are ineffective. Believe it or not, there's a policy angle there. Also about why UK research groups are pledging more openness in animal research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.